gprof on Linux is that gprof doesn't profile into the OpenGL code. It only profiles your code. So gprof will go, hey, your code's running great, but it's not. You need a way of getting right into the GL driver, and that's quite difficult. Linux doesn't have very good profiling support, so you keep that in mind. But anyway, so we draw three lines, and we're done. You can replace the word lines with polygon or outline or a bunch of other different kinds of things it can do. Everything in OpenGL is based on primitives, lines, triangles, and polygon strips. Everything else is a combination of that. There's no way you can even draw a circle. The way you draw a circle is you draw a bunch of lines all connected together, and you have to do that yourself. There are also some other functions you can call, like GL torus and GL sphere and all this. Glut sphere and glut torus. They will generate you a sphere automatically without you having to do the dirty work for it. So the AR toolkit thing that I showed with the little cube, you can go in there and replace it with a donut, a sphere, a VRML object, whatever you want to do, quite easily. And the teapot as well. There's glut teapot, so you can put that in there and do the standard graphics thing. Actually, interesting little tidbit is that the teapot that we have nowadays is actually wrong. The original teapot was stretched, and that was because back in the old days they had a different aspect ratio on computers, and our aspect ratio is different, and the teapots we render actually are not quite correct. Okay, so once we've drawn those lines, so that's the red, green, and blue axes, the next step is we need to draw the squares with the video texture. So I have a function here called square texture that does all the work. You then do geo-rotate, square texture, geo-rotate, square texture. Now the cool part about OpenGL is you can draw a primitive, rotate, draw another primitive, rotate, draw another primitive, and OpenGL will do all the dirty work for you. So you can very quickly construct up things quite easily. And you can have subroutines, so you can call square texture and then just repeat that code over and over again. So let's just find that code. Where is it? Okay. If you look in square texture, this is where it's actually done. So we call GL enable to say turn texture mapping on. By default it's not turned on because you don't always want texture mapping. When you're drawing lines, you don't want texture mapping turned on. So you enable texture mapping, you then bind a texture ID. Whenever you pass the texture to OpenGL, it gives you a handle to refer to it with. And that SGI have these really cool cards that they have, it was this reality monster box we were playing with years ago, and they actually allocate texture number 0 to a live TV input, and you don't have to do anything on the computer whatsoever, and you can watch TV on a texture map. And they actually had this VR simulation where you could walk around and you could sit down and watch TV on a virtual VRML television set. And you could do that with this as well. I mean, if you've got a TV card, that like one of those BTTV TV cards, you could have like a virtual living room app and you could drive through it and then you could watch TV on a little polygon. You could do stuff like that. So it's all very easy. I mean, that app I've shown you, you could hook it right into here and it would do it. So you then have to scale the image a little bit. And then what you do is, this is a GL quad, which is a four-sided polygon. And what you do is you call GL vertex to do the four corners. But what you do is you have to specify the coordinates in texture space that they correspond to as well. So the texture is this big. You say this point of texture space maps to this point on the polygon, and you go through it, and it does it for you. But one of the interesting parts about textures in OpenGL is they have to be a binary power of 2. So in this case, the texture is actually, there's a border around it that's not being used. That's why I've done this crazy scaling thing here, is to compensate for that. And when you're done, you disable texture mapping. Now, one of the killers with OpenGL is it's got a pipeline. And so if you turn on and off texture mapping, on and off, on and off, it actually causes a stall on the pipeline. And like in a CPU, when you get an interrupt and an instruction, it sort of gets a stall on the pipeline as well. If you do too many state changes in OpenGL, the whole system will go to a crawl. So what you do is, let's say you've got to render 5 texture map polygons and 5 normal polygons. The naive way is to go polygon, texture map, because you end up changing state over and over again. The smart way is to collect together all the primitives that are of the same type and render them all together. That way you minimize state changes. So in my Tinmis software, I render polygons with outlines. What you do is you render all the polygons first, and then you render all the outlines, then you render all the texture maps, and you do them in different passes. So you traverse through your display structure multiple times. It's a pain, but it gives you better performance. This is where it starts getting tricky. You won't have to deal with this stuff if you've got a, if you're just writing simple apps. But when you start rendering thousands of objects, then things start to cause grief, and you've got to start paying attention to performance. What else we got here? Okay. I'll talk about... I'll talk about the video stuff that's the next part. Actually, it's 3:30 right now, so I think we're supposed to have a break right now. Okay, so we're going to have a break for half an hour. I'm happy to field any questions during the break. Otherwise, we'll meet back here at 4 o'clock. Thanks for coming. I don't think it's running right now. Oh, one thing I've got right now is we bought this Toshiba Tekra M3. That's sexy. And what we're actually going to do is we're actually going to rip the motherboard out of it. We actually have opened it once already. And the motherboard in it is that big. And it's got GeForce MX on it. And it's got Centrino. And that's our next backpack. It's going to be that. So we're going to rip it apart. Oh, yeah, we don't want that. Centrino stuff works well. Yeah, well, the thing... Well, that thing there is a P3, 1.2 gigahertz with a GeForce 2. That runs well. So this Toshiba is like 4 times faster than that one. And the Toshiba is way overpowered for what I want. So I'm really... And the thing I like about the Toshiba is I can get those motherboards for the next 4 years. And because they've got warranty. So for $1,500, I can buy new motherboards without the laptop. And I'm tired of hardware changing all the time. Yeah. So the thing is, I want to build a system and then I never want to change it ever again. And so, well, that stuff there, that stuff there though, is I've had that laptop for about 3 years, and when I want to build, I've got these defense guys who want, they want me to build a backpack for them, and I want to make sure that if I build one or two or three, that a year from now I can build another one, and it'll be the same, because I'm tired of changing stuff, because every time, I've been forced to upgrade to 2.6, I used to use 2.4, 2.4, the only thing with 2.6 that we don't have, we need 2.6 for our FTDI serial to USB converters. It's the only thing that doesn't work in 2.4, but it's forced me. And then when I moved to that, then the NVIDIA driver had some issue with my GL code, and I had to rewrite it in a different way. And once one thing changes, then the whole system is, it's difficult. Yeah. So that one's running alright still. So,
This is a little bad thing to get to the issue.
Cool. Alright, cheers. Thanks.
Just a quick back to the R1 and I've got a new R26 now.
Yes.
I've read the user select on NAS test for the file iPads on the 26.
No, I haven't had drum. 26 is better actually. What did you talk
about? Oh, because the actual FileWire people actually say that the 26 stack is instead of 2.4, but they don't have any detail.
Okay, see, I used to use 2.4 and I wrote this crazy script. sort of built Wayne's optimal kernel that does all the stuff I need to do.
Okay.
It doesn't have SCSI in it or anything like that, but you can use that as a base to tweak it. And that seems to work alright, so
okay.
Send an email. Yeah, yeah. That's a pretty crappy camera. The other problem is it's very dark in here. If you give really good sunlight, it gets a lot better. What it does is it has an aperture rate, or like how wide it opens the lens up to take the light in, and it's got really wide open, and it blurs because it's quite dark. I mean, if you actually look at this camera actually sees better in dark than people do. Like, we've been outside where you almost can't see anything. That camera actually can see. It's blurry, but it is quite good at low light, but it slows itself down. The Coriander program is actually cool because it has the ability to adjust all the settings. So you can hijack the brightness, contrast, everything, and take control of it. So, and I've actually, as part of my software, I've got it so that when it starts up, it hard codes those values in to do it every time. But yeah, Coriander's quite good at that. I need to fire up for 2 seconds, but yeah.
The AR tracking with the... You were saying that it's jittery. Is that with Kalman filtering, or could that be included?
You can filter it to some degree, but the problem with Kalman filtering is if you've got garbage in, garbage comes out still. And you can smooth it, but the problem is that like if you want to build a virtual laser pointer that extends off your hand with a little marker, you end up with this pole on the end that, even if you've got Kalman filtering, it's still... I mean, the trick is to get a better camera that's more high resolution, less noise, better markers.
Well,
that's the way to improve it. But the actual putting a Kalman filtering on is cheating. The trick is to go into AR Toolkit and they have this thing called subpixel filtering that you can do, where you try to look at the blurry parts of the image and try to work out a bit more information out of it, and it gives you better tracking overall. So yeah.
Or you can just take the virtual laser pointer and make it so that the dot actually moves reasonably.
AR Toolkit's a crappy tracker. I mean, it's not great. Like, it works well for what it does, which is putting little houses on little markers and moving them around, but it's not very good as a pointing device. You're better off getting a real... I mean, you need really super-duper accurate tracking as a pointing device, and even the best trackers money can buy still are kind of okay, but not great, even they jitter. So we're talking like 0.01 of a degree. Still means you miss the seat if you're trying to aim a laser at someone in the back room, so... It all makes a difference.
But actually, while I was asking about AR tracker using it for locating yourself,
mm-hmm.
So if you use the same camera for the stuff you're seeing and locating yourself, then you don't have a mismatch between virtual stuff and...
Well, what we did with ours was we built... so slow. We've got three cameras, camera. We've got a new one with a swivel camera. And it basically looks a little marked and placed on the ceiling. And the trick is you've got to have enough cameras that you've statistically got a probability that there's always going to be one marker in view. It's accurate to about 10, 20 centimetres. It's quite slow. It's kind of... It's just...
As a supplement or something else.
You use it when you've got no money to buy a real tracker. When you're in academia, you don't get a paper just because you made something cheap.
Yeah.
Like, because most tracking systems are cheap, they're just expensive because they sell a small number of units. If I sold this, I'd have to sell it for 20 grand as well. And so, I mean, all trackers cost 10 to 20 grand, but they're actually the hardware is quite cheap. If you can build it yourself, then it's free.
Yeah.
The AR Toolkit is not the best way of building a tracker. I've used it because I don't want to write my own, but there are really good trackers that do optical stuff that do natural feature recognition. What they'll do is they'll lock onto corners of lights and boxes and things,
and
they then do optical flow. And what you do is you combine that with an accelerometer sensor, and you bring all these sensors together, and then you get really good output.
You get really big paper about sensor fusion.
There's a system you can buy called an IS-1200. It's made by a company called Innosense, who make the sensor cube on here.
Yeah.
What they did is they took this sensor cube, they also read the accelerometer data out, and they have a video camera that looks up, and they have these markers that slap on the ceiling, and it locks onto them, but it uses the accelerometers, gyros, and everything else, and it works really well. And you can move your hands in front of it, shake it, and it just works. It's very robust. And
this one is...
And the other thing is, it's self-calibrating as well.
Yeah.
So you throw the markers up, sweep it over, and it actually calibrates the markers. Mine, I have to actually program them in manually, because the accuracy is so poor that if you calibrated it with that, you would end up doubling the error. And so, like, if you're a proper vision person and you write it properly, you get good results. This is a hack. Our toolkit was never intended to do this, and it does it, but there's always dodgy things I had to do internally to it. Like, there's this problem that it has with the camera calibration code. It doesn't do a very good job, so I had to go in there and tweak the values of the matrix to sort of straighten it out a bit. And I did it, but you shouldn't do it that way. It's just, it's evil. So, yeah. Yeah, the problem is that if you've got a really poor model of the environment, that, like, the errors compound. So if you've got a really super accurate sensor and you're measuring it, then it'll work okay.
Yeah, providing some more metrics
with
video or something like
that.
The
Yeah, I said someone's done it. But that guy is a Karman Fritzl kingpin. I mean, this thing has a Karman Fritzl on it as well. This guy, he's like the world's leading researcher on these kind of trackers. Everything he does is brilliant. Like, all his sensor stuff is really awesome. So, and he has a pile of patents on the Karman Fritzl because they're just awesome. Like, yeah. This one's 10 hertz. The RTK ones are 30 or more. It depends on the processing power inside them. Yeah, generally, as they improve the CPU speed, then you can get faster updates. Oh, yeah, yeah. So the problem he has, the problem they have is that a lot of the GPS chipset manufacturers put limits in that say, we won't do tracking beyond so many kilometers an hour because they don't want people to make missiles out of them. So the GPS companies all have a gentleman's agreement where they agree that if the unit is moving faster than 400 kilometers an hour, then stop it from working or just don't put any data out. And because there's only a small amount... So, I mean, I'm all cool with having everything open, but at the same time, like, you know, he said he got those emails from those people in Korea. I mean, you know, if it's some rogue country building a cruise missile, you can do some real, like, we're talking serious weaponry here. This is no longer, you know, we're not talking about a Wi-Fi card that's going to, like, you know, interfere with someone's TV set. You can make some very dangerous gear using a GPS and a plane, and that's the problem. It's sort of, I'm kind of cool with those kind of rules, like, because, you know, I mean, do people really need to fire rockets? Like, it's not really it's not critical.
If you're going to attack someone with a GPS, you have to take a small model plane that doesn't go that fast.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what the speed limit is. Because some pilots use GPSs in their own planes to navigate. And you can buy GPSs that are more expensive that do it. I'm not sure. I don't know what the rules are on that. I'm not. This one here, because it's expensive, this one might do it. I don't know. I've never taken it past 500 kilometres an hour. My car doesn't go that fast. So yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things that, like, it's like you buy DAT tape recorders and CD burners and stuff. I mean, the really expensive, high-end, top-end stuff, they tend to bypass all security features because you tend to be a company that's doing it for some reason. Like, so it's the cheap stuff that they tend to cripple. But the expensive stuff tends to do everything. It's just the way it's done. So,
that's
sure.
They only cripple amateur pirates. And
yeah.
The professional pirates
can still do it properly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, is that the thing with the problem? Can you use the laser?
Google for riprap and REPA for and BAF, you will find the number one hit on Google.
Okay.
Is
Yeah.
So I some pictures of the panel page if you want to have a look.
Because one thing that's kind of playing with this is doing some tabletop organism related stuff. And you want to have the ability to fab up solid shapes. And yeah, so we bought this drilling machine. It's quite slow though, but we want to play with it. It's like foam and yeah, we want to see what it can do.
It's called Stratasys. It's for plastic. It's for solid plastic and supported plastic. So you can do any kind of
dissolve the supported plastic away.
Yeah. And Zedcorp do a plaster injector. So you put down a layer of plaster and you inject something onto it, and it tries to plaster the top of the tip. And then you put down another thin layer of plaster whilst and then you print it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of that one is you can print in 24 times.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And then you don't depend on the quality or whatnot. You use the Brazilian lime tool bank, and then you end up with something that's like 40% faster than the same time and it's quite hot.
Cool. So, I mean, how much of this stuff you've been building? Have you done much?
No, I mean, my machine, well, I've done a bit with sort of just producing demo parts like spanners and brackets.
So, what are you using for like driving? Because our students, they do these a bunch of printout arms. They use like the print racks that they're doing tomorrow, and they sort of break up the code.
Well, it's the classic XY3 thing in the commercial stuff. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to use a turntable because it's easier to use rotation with metric parts. And you can't do straight lines or slow down.
It's like a lot of
And we're trying to keep it simple. So obviously we don't need any double parts. Once it's out there under the GPL, people can use it to print more.
Yeah, but
parts
that's something I'm definitely interested in. I'll send to my students to have a look at. But if you want to send me an email,
certainly will.
That's something, I said, I've got a lot of dudes who are really keen on CNC stuff. And the dream is one day having one of those resin printing things.
It's easier to have print of plastic and use a resin part.
Yeah.
And also the printing of plastic is going to be much more robust, which is interesting when you've got students around.
Okay.
If you want me to put you on the news list,
is that on there? I'll just go to it.
So, yeah, homeless is a separate thing. I do tech news and I cover that sort of area.
Okay. How often do you do that?
Three times a week. We have two lines for article followed by URL.
All right, we'll put me on that. Yeah. They got it a couple of weeks ago and they've just been running the machine for the same kind of stuff. What kind of software are you using to control it? Because we're playing with a bunch of dodgy DOS programs. I found there's a Linux project.
Penguin RP. The Red Hat thing's got a long way to go.
Because we had problems with, we were trying to play with Linux, we ended up just using a little DOS machine with a big floppy.
Because
you couldn't get the G code and stuff.
Yeah, there's one or two from the link.
It was almost so complicated when it was together.
Yeah, there's some work that we've improved it. There's links to their work on the Red Hat site.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll have to have a look at that because we didn't realise it was project Linux.
Nor did I. It was sort of written out the same way from that and got to value.
Yeah.
And thought, well, okay, I've got down to producing PCB prototypes now.
Okay,
using
cool.
Conductive silver paint.
Yeah,
because
my students will use this to make PCBs. So.
Yeah, I draw the board. Put down a sheet of pieces of glass, draw them with conductive silver paint, then put hot melt glue over it. Put some solid substrate in painted plastic or it could be plywood holes drilled in there, turn it over, push the components through the dry rack and into lines on the paint until the paint, so the legs go through the holes in the plywood or whatever you're looking at. And the silver paint connects the legs and you have a circuit to push in parts and it works.
Oh, cool. Oh, I'll have to have a look at that.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Much appreciated. Thanks again.
Indoors here is very hard to judge because the lighting conditions are so poor that the camera has to open its lowers the exposure rate. Yeah,
that camera's not all that great.
If you use it outside though, it's a lot better. If you saw the video I had, just everything was a lot better than in here. So there are issues with the camera. Honestly, the more money you spend on a camera. There's this company called Point Grey that sell really nice flywire cameras, like $1,000 US a pop, but they're really, really good, and you get what you pay for. So, yeah, but little webcam tends to be more quality.
Have you tried the Apple iPhone?
No, I've actually got one in order. I've heard they're terrible though. I've heard they've got a lot of lag. Some Mac friend of mine was telling me. I've applied for a grant from Apple, and one was going to send me a couple of PowerBooks and an iSight to try out as well, so we're going to see how we go. You know what I like about the iSight? It's very long. It's a very long body, which is like all the HMV. I'm going to see if we can fit it in somehow. But
yeah.
I have this really
I guess you could fit it there, but that gets to offset.
Yeah.
You don't want either bit offset, really.
Yeah.
I guess
think
I could go up.
The Point Grey cameras are nice because actually the motherboard is attached to the camera.
Mm.
So the camera is that big, it's got a ribbon cable.
Yeah.
And you can put the motherboard wherever you want. So, yeah, there's a lot you can do there.
Thank you.
supposed to start now, or? Okay. Well, it's 4:05, so we'll get going. Okay, so let's get going. Once again, make sure you go to my URL if you want to see any of the examples, notes, code examples, so forth, all the slides, everything's all there. So make sure you have a look. So we went through the source code example, and now what we're going to do is discuss camera issues and some rendering stuff and hardware. There's one more slide I wanted to talk about. You can write graphics applications in OpenGL, but the thing with OpenGL is it is quite low level. You know, draw a line, draw this, draw that. If you want to draw things like circles or spheres or large meshes, you really want a library of some kind to do the dirty work for you, because it does get quite messy. OpenGL is also quite complicated. When you want to squeeze the best performance out of it, you really do have to know a lot about it to get that performance. Otherwise, it's difficult. In graphics programming, we have a term which is called a scene graph. And what a scene graph does is it's a kind of abstraction layer that we use to help us write applications. So you tell the scene graph, here's a VRML file, or here is a collection of 3D objects. You render them. And some scene graphs are written so they'll talk to OpenGL, DirectX, and so forth. And so you can make your app portable between platforms. So, for example, you want to write for Linux but also sell apps for Windows, then you can do that. So there are a bunch of scene graphs available that you can use. These ones are all free. What a scene graph does is it has hierarchies of objects. So what you'll do is you'll create a room. And then inside a room, you'll create a chair object. And you'll instantiate the chair object 500 times through this room here. And the scene graph will just replay the same 3D drawing commands for every single chair, so you don't have to do it. Then what you can do is you can say, okay, well, I want to have the room, and then I want to have that broken up into three parts, left, center, and right. And all the right chairs will get attached to the right node, and so forth. And then when a person sits down on a chair, you'll attach that person to that chair node. If you want to specify someone's body in a scene graph, this is the main node, and then the arm hangs off that, then the elbow hangs off that, then the wrist, then the fingers, and so forth. The neat part about a scene graph is if you've got it specified as a hierarchy, you can change the matrix on this elbow here, and the whole arm will move with it. If you move this elbow, all of the fingers, which are all articulated, will all move with the scene graph. So scene graphs handle complicated motions very easily for you. So really, you do want to use a scene graph of some kind. There's also Java 3D for Java, same thing. So the nice part about these scene graphs is they're written by really smart people who know what they're doing. In the case of Open Inventor, that was sort of one of the first really good scene graphs that was done. SGI wrote that one. I use what's called Coin3D, which is a free library that's GPL'd. It's Coin3D is with a similar license as Qt. It's basically, it's GPL'd code, but if you want to use it for commercial apps, you can buy a license off them for it, so it's quite good. But it is properly GPL'd. So I use Coin3D to load VRML files into my software and then to render them, because I don't want to write my own VRML parser because it's quite complicated. VRML is a really complicated format to read. You really don't want to write your own parser. Use someone else's code unless you're like into causing pain. There are a number of other scene graphs you can use. OpenSG, OpenSceneGraph, and OpenVRML. OpenVRML, my understanding is it doesn't seem to be as supported as well as the other ones. I've tried to use OpenVRML, and it was in a state of flux when I looked at it. It was kind of broken a little bit. OpenSceneGraph and OpenSG. SceneGraph actually has a Debian package. When I pick APIs to do things, I tend to pick things that have Debian packages if I can, because I don't want to compile tarballs up. And it also indicates how mature a package is if it has a Debian package. If it doesn't have a Debian package, then it could disappear off the radar. Whereas if something's in Debian, it tends to stay around for a lot longer. So I do try to stick with stuff with packages. So OpenSceneGraph is good, and Coin3D has packages as well. The only problem with Coin3D is they have really excellent docs that are generated. They've got really good API docs, but they don't have any examples. It's like when you read the said man page. It's got every option available, but it doesn't actually give you one example to actually use. And so that's the problem with Coin3D. And there's two books that have been written about it called The Inventor Mentor and something else. The problem with the Inventor Mentor book is you can't buy it anymore. It stopped. It went out of print. You can't get PDFs or anything. So I happen to have the books, so I use them. But the documentation for Inventor has kind of disappeared a bit. So you might want to try OpenSceneGraph or OpenSG. They all read VRML files, I believe. I said I've used Coin,
and I've got a student of mine playing with OpenSceneGraph right now. So there's something you want to consider. So if you're writing a game, you really do need an engine of some kind on top of it to sort of do a lot of the messy work for you. The other thing they do is they do a lot of optimized rendering. All those problems that I talked about with turning on and off the state machine, the scene graphs tend to support that for you. So a scene graph will render graphics probably faster than you could do if you wrote it by hand, because they know more about it. They also do things like animations and scripting and so forth. So it's just a lot of capability in there that makes your life easy. Collision detection. Doing all that stuff yourself is really hard. So using a scene graph makes your life easy. All right, so next step, video capture. So we had an example before where we showed live video being thrown onto a polygon. Now we're going to show you how to grab the video to feed into it. So capturing video is done under Linux. You can do it. The problem with video capture is there aren't that many people that do it. Like, you know, if you have a problem with the IDE driver, odds are there's 40 million other people out there that also have a problem with the IDE driver, so it gets fixed straight away. With the video stuff, it can break and not many people will notice because there's less users. I mean, you know, how many people in this audience have used video for Linux or FireWire cameras before? So there's a couple. Everyone's going to put their hand up now to make me look like a liar. The thing is that there's not as many people that have the problems that people who do video have. So there's kind of less support for it. The libraries aren't as nice and stuff like that. The interfaces tend to be non-trivial. The documentation is kind of a bit iffy. So we're going to talk about these things to help you understand it better. What we really need is like a nice userland API that abstracts all these things away. There are a couple. There's one called GStreamer, which someone told me about last year. I kind of played with it, but I couldn't work out how to hook GStreamer into my application. GStreamer is really good. It's a generic framework that will read video cameras, video files, and so forth, and display them in a GTK widget or whatever. The problem is I didn't have any examples that were able to extract the video out as a char star pointer so I could feed it into a texture. The documentation was kind of iffy, and I haven't been able to use GStreamer yet, so I've got to talk to the guys who do it and get them to help me out or something like that. But for now, I've been talking directly to the cameras myself, so we're going to talk about how to do that. The GStreamer stuff, what it does is it's very similar to Windows' Direct Show architecture. Now, as much as we all don't like Windows, Direct Show, the idea behind it is quite good. You have a bunch of sources like video files, cameras, whatever, and it's got these generic plugins that you can attach and build a pipeline out of, and then you say to it, look, I want video in RGB with 640 by 480, and GStream will get it for you. If it has to scale it, it'll do it, whatever. The problem with the raw APIs provided by the kernel is that if you ask the camera for, hey, can I have a 320 by 240 image, and the camera is only 640 by 480, the kernel will just go, no, you deal with it. And then you have to write all this code in here. So having these frameworks makes things easy. And so things like GStreamer are the way of the future. So, you know, I'm hoping to use that soon because I think it'll make my life a lot easier. And it means we don't have to write code for multiple different kinds of cameras. So there's not too much docs, so we're going to go through that a bit to help you out. Video for Linux, which is abbreviated to V4L, was the first API that they wrote for capture drivers. Originally what happened was is that it was written for a capture board called a BTTV or something like that. And the API was written for that card, and then they kind of extended it and hacked it to support different kinds of cameras. The V4L API is kind of old. It's very iOctal-ish. You've got to, you know, do everything by hand. There's no nice library to make your life easy. There's a little program called XAWTV that will view video for Linux output. And basically, the interface is quite simple. You open the device, you do read calls to read data from the camera, and then you use iOctal calls to configure it. It's the iOctal that calls you the grid. When you ask the kernel for video, you say, I'd like this resolution, this pixel format, and so forth and so forth, and the kernel then replies back going no, and then you've got to keep going to the kernel until you negotiate a suitable format to grab the video out. Now, one of the things Alan Cox didn't like with the video for Linux stuff is people started putting code into the kernel that would do YUV to RGB conversions and all this kind of stuff. You really don't want that in the kernel because, you know, it's more stuff, it's a potential security hole and so forth. So the kernel guys really want to rip out as much of this conversion code as they can and put it in user space. Doing conversions is something that GStreamer should be doing in userland as a library. So you basically got to supply your own conversions. And I've had some problems with V4L. If you do, reload the modules. That tends to work quite well. So if your camera gets in a state where it won't detect you all of a sudden, you reload the modules, sometimes it'll straighten it out.
Linux is one of those operating systems where you never reboot it. Like, just, you run it forever. However, when you start playing with video stuff, that kind of changes and things are not as reliable. The drivers for these cameras are usually written by, like, one person. They're not tested all that well, so they're not really super-duper robust, so you may run into issues. There's a driver called CPIA, which I use for these little cameras that I have. It's kind of reliable. It stopped working in 2.6 because the kernel developers, in all their wisdom, decided my camera didn't quite follow the spec for USB, and the kernel goes, oh, this camera didn't reply back with quite the perfect response. I'm going to disable it. And it's like, there's no kernel option that says to allow dodgy cameras equals yes. There are people that have produced, the thing that annoys me is there are people that make patches to disable this code. It would be much better if there was a menu config option that's just allow dodgy devices. And the kernel documentation says, oh, upgrade your firmware. It's like, well, what if my camera doesn't have firmware that can be upgraded? That's the problem. So I'm kind of annoyed at that. USB 2 cameras, I don't think any of them are supported. USB cameras never really took off in Linux. FireWire cameras are the way to go. If you're doing any video stuff, do that. USB 1 cameras, the quality of them is shocking. And they also, the quality's not as good compared to Windows ones either. I think what happens is that the manufacturers have some kind of generic chipset that they tweak, and they've released the specs for some of the modes, but not all of the high quality ones that have a certain kind of compression. Yeah. Yeah. They usually run it, the ones I've got usually run about 352 by 288. Yeah, and the quality's shocking, they've got dodgy compression. What I did notice though, is that the same camera under Windows and Linux, the quality was better under Windows. And I think it's because there's some secret compression mode that if you turn it on, you can get better quality. So, USB cameras are evil, don't do them. There are lots of capture boards though, like PCI cards. They're all video for Linux based, and they tend to work quite well. They've been around for a long time. Buy the one with the right chipset that's supported and you should have no dramas. And they all have, there's one chipset called an SAA 7 something or other which is used by most of them, I think. And yeah, just go to the kernel, find a module that works and then use that. There's a new Video for Linux 2 API that's available in 2.5 and 2.6 kernel. And it's kind of weird because you sort of, you look for information about it, there's not much information. It's got a website that's like bytesex.org or something like that. And that doesn't really look professional in my opinion. But kind of, there's a Video for Linux 2 API, but it's not really, the documentation's kind of all over the place. I'm not really sure where you stand with it, and it hasn't been updated since 2.5 kernel and stuff like that. So what they do is some of the drivers have been moved to Video for Linux 2, but not all of them have, so you've got to be careful for that. So if you use the old V4L API, it'll work. If you use Video for Linux 2, there's like a compatibility layer. They still haven't changed any of the flaws in V4L though, so it's sort of, you still need a userland library to do compression and conversions and all this other kind of stuff if you want that. So we're going to do V4L code because that's what all the kernel drivers support. So if we go to the code, so I've got a file called v4l.cc and I've got some nice functions that do all the dirty work. So I've got a function called open, another one called start, capture, and that's it, get V4L. Get V4L just returns a frame back. So this code is like the simplest possible code you can have to do video for Linux. I've got a bunch of structures that store information about the camera, a bunch of static constants. Then, so what you do is you open the device up, so just using a standard open call. The important thing to realize with video for Linux is that it doesn't support non-blocking mode. My whole app on my backpack is all written using a select statement that monitors a pile of file descriptors. Video for Linux doesn't do non-blocking, so it'll if you ask for it, it'll go, yeah, sure, I'll give you non-blocking, and then you call it, it blocks. So the only way you can do it is you have a thread running on the side. So this example here that I've given you doesn't have threads. Basically, it only refreshes the screen once per frame. I didn't want my software to be restricted to the rate of the camera, though, so I had to run a thread for it. Threads are kind of evil, too, though. And you also can't run GDB on a video, on a FireWire video program, and not Video for Linux, either. If you attach GDB, it kind of does weird stuff when you've got threading and all this kind of stuff happening. So, yeah, these iOctals also start to fail sometimes if you're running GDB. So sometimes you have to attach GDB to the process afterwards. But anyway, so iOctal video CG cap, which basically you can grab a bunch of information about the device. So you can say what's the name of the device, the width and the height supported, channel numbers, because a lot of cards have TV tuners built in.
You can do that.
So what you do is I read all these values in, and then hit the laser and go. He's not getting the little coupon for the USB stick. Actually, I need to work out how I'm going to give that away still. Okay. Alright, anyway, so I read the video width and height values from the camera, and then what I do is make sure that you have a width and a height that's less than the maximum from the camera. If you ask for too much, then the kernel will reject it. So then what we do is we set the default channel, and we then grab channel info. You can pick between PAL and NTSC and tuning and all this kind of stuff, so that's all done here. You then do a call to set that information. So it's all done with iOctals and little structures. You then can configure all the brightness settings. So a lot of these cameras are tweakable. You can adjust the brightness, hue, contrast, and all this, and you can hard code them all in. So I pick defaults here and supply them in here. You then set the mode you want. So I ask for RGB24. So this camera happens to support RGB24, so I was lucky. Some cameras don't, you're in trouble. The whole thing's done with a memory map. So you supply a piece of memory and it does transfer straight into that memory. So we get the information about the memory map, and then we make sure we ask for 2 frames. If you don't get 2 frames, then that causes problems. So what it does is it gives you, if the video frames are 300 kilobytes each, it'll allocate 600K, and then it'll flip back and forth between them, so it's reading into one while you're processing the next one. We then do an mmap to create some space for it, put in the values of the width and height, and then you're done. So those are the iOctals that do it. So this is kind of stuff that I've derived from looking at different source code and reading kernel things, and you gradually work it out how to do it, so that's a way that works. Now, when you want to initiate capture, there's this dot frame variable in the structure here. You can pick between dot frame 0 and frame 1. And so this iOctal tells it to activate capturing. And all this code does here is it just activates capturing on both buffers just to sort of get the pipeline rolling. And then we're done. Now, to capture a frame, you call this function. So you do capture v4l. So it toggles the frame number. It then does an iOctal to the kernel. Now, this iOctal here... This one says I'm finished with the previous frame, and this iOctal is the one that causes the problem. This one says, okay, now get me the next frame. This is where it blocks, and your code will pause here for the amount of time it takes to suck the frame in. So you really need to put this in a thread if you want to have other things happening at the same time. The thing to realize, though, is if you're writing threaded programs, you've got to be careful that your toolkit or whatever supports threading. OpenGL is not thread safe. It has no concept of context. So if you have 2 threads and one of them's drawing graphics and the other one's reading the video and then drawing textures, everything will die. So you've got to make sure that that you have a thread doing the capture into memory, but then the main thread that's doing the drawing grabs the frame and renders it. So all the OpenGL calls must occur within one thread only. A lot of this applies to most GUI toolkits as well. I'm not familiar with Qt or GTK, but I imagine they're probably not thread safe either. So that call there tells it, get me a frame. That iOctal then returns, and now you're ready to grab the frame and do something with it. So I have a little function, get v4l. It just returns a pointer to a char star block of memory that has the RGB data in it. So if it's 320 by 200, that's 64,000. Multiplied by 3 for RGB is 192,000. It's 192,000 bytes of memory. That's your picture. Bang, you're ready. So once you've got that picture, you now need to put it on a texture map. You could render it to X Windows or write to a file, whatever you want to do. What we're going to do now is render it to a texture. So texture.cc, somewhere in here. Okay, so this is where we create the texture. So when you want to make something into a texture, this is a bunch of... Basically, I'm just creating a buffer for it. Now, I said before that OpenGL requires power of 2 textures. So if you have a picture from a camera that's 320 by 240... it has to round it up to the nearest power of 2. So the nearest power of 2 is 512 by 256. So that's how big the arrays you have to create. So you create this array, and you give it to OpenGL, and that's the initial texture. So it's just all gray or something like that. So that's what we do here. So we set the initial size. There's a couple calls you have to make to OpenGL to tell it what kind of data we're going to be loading in. You allocate a texture ID. You bind it to make it active. And then you've got to set these parameters which control how filtering occurs and smoothing and stuff like that. different filtering will affect performance. We really don't have too much time to go through that. So the next thing is GL text image 2D. So what this does is this loads in the initial image we created up here. This image doesn't contain a picture from the camera in it. It's just a blank texture that we're just using to kickstart OpenGL. There's a reason we do this, so I'll explain that in a minute. So we tell OpenGL we want to do a 2D texture. The texture is in an RGBA 8 format, and that's the width and height for the texture, and that's the format it's coming in and so forth. That actually tells the video card what format it should store it internally. This announces the format that the video data is coming from the camera. So if you're